point. It was worth making in any discussion which touches upon us deeply. Bernstein and Lattimore. It's very much to her credit that she, unlike so many German social democrats, at the testing time of the war, opposed the war, and was rather lonely in that opposition. It's odd and interesting that another of the opponents of the war was Edward Bernstein, who in so many other respects was a frank but in fact a reformist. But when it came to war, he was opposed to it, whereas people at this party, rightly in the particular context in which they're admiring counselors who wrote economic textbooks, which were required reading in the early days of the party, and still would do, again, there's no harm in fact to read, in the economic field of explaining Marxian economics. But as a politician and as an MP, he was supporting the war, which Bernstein, the reformist, non-Marxist, was opposing. So that's an interesting contrast. Another thing about the war, which I think is worth making, is that there were reasons other than the obvious German patriotism and chauvinism of millions of SD voters. Besides, there were other reasons, and more plausible, if you like, from the point of view of people from the socialist tradition. Not acceptable, of course, not correct. But they said, I mean, Germany in that situation was fighting on two fronts. It was fighting against Russia, which meant they could claim that, you know, a war against Tsarist autocracy is something that no socialist would have any problem of supporting. And on the other front, they were fighting against British and French imperialism, as they claimed. And what socialist wouldn't jump at the opportunity to fight against the British imperialism which had crushed the heroic Boers in the South African War? And so on. That was the kind of sentiment they also drew upon in justifying their support for the war. But one omission that you made, and although I didn't see the film, I still hope to see it, I believe the film also made, and I think it's particularly relevant in the case of Rosa Luxemburg, probably a lot less relevant in the case of Marx, and that was the Jewish background from which he came. And Marx came from a Jewish background, but it was very much in the background, and he was brought up as a Christian, and it was technically he was Jewish, and no doubt he would have qualified for the gas chamber in another period, not so many years later. But so far as association with being Jewish, in Marx's case, it was in Rosa Luxemburg's case. She grew up, as you said, in Eastern Poland, and that wasn't academic or tenuous or unconnected at all. It was very much part of her youthful experience. In my view, that would go to explain a very important difference between Rosa Luxemburg and Marx, which I view, and I apologize for London members who may be familiar with the views I made with, but I think it's relevant any time Rosa Luxemburg is discussed and mentioned. And that is, we all know that Marx got rather involved in day-to-day assessments of the forces of capitalism and the preferences of lead amongst those forces, which he thought were leading to better things. And in the faced with the Crimean War, we wouldn't endorse that position, but we well know the fact that Marx supported the Russian, the British, French, and Turkish war against the Russians, because he's considered that Tsarist Russia, rather like the Kautsky would have argued in the time of the First World War as a reason to support that war, but Marx argued that Tsarist Russia was the greatest single force for backing this and against the kind of necessary development of the preconditions for socialism. And so, running all through Marx's mind was this special opposition to that which emanated from Tsarist Russia. And so, because he was so opposed to Tsarist Russia, he tended to look rather favourably on all those elements that were a thorn in the side of Tsarist Russia. And one of the thorns in the side of Tsarist Russia was Polish nationalism, because it would be very bothersome for Tsarist Russia and independent Poland, just as it is bothersome for Bolshevik Russia, for that matter, an independent colony. But Rosa Luxemburg, on the other hand, having grown up in Poland, in a Jewish atmosphere, especially relevant to mention this particular point at that moment, atmosphere in Poland, she could have a detached, tactical approval of Polish nationalism as a botheration to the Tsarist ruling system. She, living in the middle of Polish nationalism, as a Jewish young woman, saw the vicious and virulent anti-Semitism, which was part of the deal of Polish nationalism. They went together, and so she could share Marx's automatic enthusiasm for Polish nationalism insofar as it bothered the Tsarist Russia. She lived in it, and she knew what that signified. That was one important difference. The other difference, I can just mention, I'm asking now too long, but whereas Marx, again, sided with Ottoman Turkey, because it was a bulwark against the Russian expansionism, she, as a woman, here again, it's very significant, as a woman, she could work up the enthusiasm Marx could on tactical grounds in Turkey, because Ottoman Turkey represented, as far as he was a woman was concerned, conditions for women in Islamic society, which again was, of inequality and oppression, which as a woman, as you said, as exceptionally bright and thinking woman, she couldn't accept it. And that person who then tended to go towards the Bulgarians, pro-Russian though they were, because they were rising up against the Ottoman domination. So, if it does nothing else, it warns us of the dangers of Marxists siding on capitalist quarrels. But it also reminds us very sharply, precisely because on several key cases she took the opposite stand to Marx on these questions. I'm not saying you should take one or the other, but the scene that they, where and how they did that, is a reminder to us of how just that kind of thing can be.
Yes.
I understand that Rosa Luxemburg made certain criticisms of Mendelssohn, which have since been evaluated, but I don't know what those criticisms were, because the Jews in Luxembourg, where Rosa Luxemburg criticized such a Lenin's theory.
Yeah. Well, she criticized the Russian Revolution in a pamphlet called The Russian Revolution, and she criticized the Bolsheviks because of the undemocratic way in which they were conducting themselves. She pointed to the fact that ever since they'd seized power, they had been suppressing any genuine democratic movement within the Russian working class. That at all costs, what they were determined to do was to impose their minority will on the rest of Russia. She condemned them in very forthright terms for us. I just wish, you know, that I'm on holiday just now. There's a great deal of stuff I would have liked to have had handy. But I didn't want to trail it about with me from town to town. And the Russian Revolution pamphlet is a terrific pamphlet. But against that, you see, against that, she later on, towards the end of her life, did make favourable noises towards the Bolsheviks. She did say that the Bolsheviks had acted correctly in all manner of circumstances where they acted undemocratically. She did come to terms with what the Bolsheviks had done in Russia, and that's something that has been seized on by the would-be modern Bolsheviks and the Communist Party and the various Trotskyist sects and so on. They say, yeah, there you are, you see. Rosa Luxemburg came to see that Lenin was right after all, and that her earlier criticism in that pamphlet was a misguided one. But if you read the pamphlet, you can see that she condemned them in no uncertain way.
Can I just make two
there's a general theme I want to raise, but a couple of preliminary questions. Vic said that the founder men and women of the Socialist Party would never have gone in for the kind of things that Rosa Luxemburg did, particularly her participation in the 1919 uprising. Well, as a point of fact, and others here may be interested in it, in the history, or what purports to be a history of the Socialist Party by Robert Baltrop, called The Monument, which I don't regard as a good history, and I think is in part a dishonest history, the statement is made that the very writer whom you quoted, namely Newman, was killed, probably, in the 1919 uprising. The writer, incidentally, wrote that without a scrap of evidence, to my knowledge, but nevertheless, I think that's just worth mentioning in relation to the comment you made. That's a sort of specific point. The other one was that in relation to Rosa Luxemburg in the present time, one of the things that has been done in relation to Rosa Luxemburg is to say, well, look, Rosa Luxemburg has been appropriated by people on the left who would call themselves feminists because she's a woman and she was a leader. Now, it strikes me that one of the bloody worst things that a woman could do, first of all, it's a patronizing attitude. There's a kind of sexism, to use that term, which is incorporated in that. You know, well, women can become leaders. Well, quite aside from the fact that there's nothing bloody great about a woman becoming a leader, I mean, we've got two of them in the top positions in this country, so it shouldn't impress any worker who's got any sense in relation to leaders. It also, in fact, is a mistaken attitude, because what Rosa Luxemburg, as far as I'm concerned, did was she took on all of the attributes traditionally taken on by dominating opportunist men who sacrificed principles and not, in fact, maintain the kind of solidarity and rejection of hierarchy which feminists would often admire. But the main point I want to make, and you didn't really touch on it, was Rosa Luxemburg's attitude to spontaneity in history. And it's always struck me that that is the main theme in Rosa Luxemburg's politics, that Rosa Luxemburg was almost obsessed by this question of whether or not historical change can happen spontaneously, whether people, as workers, kind of develop consciousness without a vanguard having to impose that consciousness upon them. And my reading of Rosa Luxemburg, and I'm interested in Vic Vanier's, is that Rosa Luxemburg gave a good deal of evidence to show that workers' ideas do not change as a result of political parties, as a result of leaders, as a result of people who claim to possess all of the knowledge. Yet, her politics were not, in fact, based upon a recognition of that. It were not, in fact, to embody that recognition. And I wonder about the extent to which the Socialist Party of Great Britain, given its smallness, given the historical circumstances we're in, no one, therefore, is casting blame or looking for rewriting of history, whether, again, the same thing is to some extent true, and whether it's true of Marx, that all the time there is a recognition that history, as it were, imposes upon the working class courses of action. And spontaneity, therefore, is much more important in social change than is political planning and premeditation. Yet at the same time, a great deal of the formal writing, at least as I read it, of Marx and of the Socialist Party, which I would on the whole endorse, doesn't seem to embody that historical recognition.
Well, Comrade Chairman, socialism, when it occurs, will not be as a result, or let me put it this way, will not only be as a result of the activities, the propaganda of a socialist party in this country or any other country. It will be because of the impact that living the life of a wage slave in capitalism has on workers, when they're faced with all the problems of that society, when they're faced with the insecurity, the degradation, and the sheer physical danger of a world war and so on, the possibility of the pollution of the earth, in the long run, that's got to wear away as a drip wears away a stone. This conviction that most people have that capitalism is the only system that ever has been and ever can be. And I think that it's the system itself that is the great educator. That's what will whip them along the road to revolution. And of course, we in the Socialist Party of Great Britain will play a part in making that sooner rather than later.
Right. Are there any more questions?
Yes. On that part of the room, I don't think much about it. But you say that she was opposed to Bernstein, the German Social Democratic Party, for the revisionist. Is there a difference between the revisionist and the reformist?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'd like to reform the theory of Karl Marx, and then subsequently tries to revise them in the way that people like Bernstein did. Bernstein, I'm sure for the best of reasons, by the way, thought that Marxist theory was no longer valid, it was no longer applicable. He had some things to say, but in the main it had been overtaken by events, and he thought that his ideas were a better set of ideas. So reformists include not just people like Bernstein or the Labour Party or the Communist Party, but also people like the Liberals, the SDP, the Alliance, or the Nazi Party, or the British National Front. They're all reformists. They all take the view that you can reform away the problems of capitalism simply by changing governments, changing laws, and things like that.
Are there any more points?
There's two specific questions I'd like to ask about. The first is that, in your comments, you compared the Spartacists pretty directly with the Bolsheviks. And I know you didn't have very long to deal with the Spartacists' precise position. You made that comparison. I don't know much about it, and I'd be interested to know just how fair is it to compare the two directly. I won't say more than that because I don't really know, but I just wonder whether they were sort of directly comparable. But the other question I'd like to ask about was that, just on that first one, in fact, the reason I think it's worth asking about that is because I'm interested to know to what extent did Rosa Luxemburg really understand the mechanism of capitalism. In other words, I'd say the key question, if we're going to sort of have a post-mortem, as it were, and really sort of chop up what did she stand for, how close was she to a genuine socialist outlook, and I suppose the key question to ask in a way is whether she understood the inevitable processes of capitalism, the fact that certain things are absolutely necessary for genuine change. And you implied pretty negatively towards the end, the latter half of your talk, that really she didn't ever properly understand that dynamic. She never quite grasped just how the thing would work. And indeed, if the Spartacists had enjoyed victory, then perhaps 10 years later, they, like the Bolsheviks, perhaps would have been in the process of locking up their opponents and so on, having failed to realise that anyone who gains power in that way would inevitably be forced into that position. Would that be a fair comparison? And the second point is that my introduction to Rosa Luxemburg has been via a pamphlet she wrote called The Mass Strike, which I think was a relatively early piece of writing on her part. I don't know if you know it, but what she's arguing there is basically that the general strike must be considered as a possibly a key means of creating a revolution. I mean, she has some reservations, but I think it's fair to say that, broadly speaking, she's in favour of a general strike as a sort of key weapon. To me, that would really come across as a syndicalist sort of argument, perhaps. Now, is that at all representative of her thought, or is that just an early aberration? I don't know.
Well, that's true that in the early part of 1919, when you stayed in the uprising, they did try to emulate the Bolsheviks. I mean, that was a model. They were trying to take advantage of what they saw as a situation that was roughly similar to that which existed in Russia in 1917.